Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me for another series of our podcast. I am extremely thankful to have the Honorable Bill Blair, our Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness. Bill doesn't really need an introduction, especially if you're in the GTA Toronto area. He was the Chief of Police for a number of years in Toronto during very interesting times in Toronto, and I'd love to chat about those with you sometime, Bill, but that's not why we're chatting today. But thanks a lot for taking the time to jump on and to join me for a few minutes to answer some important questions that are coming from my area of the province anyhow. Bill, I want to start. A lot of people are asking me questions about the border closing and how long it will be closed for, how you make the decision to extend for another month, what goes into that. Give me some feedback on that.
Yeah, certainly, Mark. And I know it's really important. It's important to every community, but certainly I know for your community in Kingston, really impacted by the border closure because, you know, Canadian economy, but also our cultures and societies are so integrated across that border. The decision to close it in that we made it back in March, it was done fairly rapidly. It's one of those things that a week before, it was inconceivable that we would close that border and then we shut it down. But we did it pretty carefully. And one of the things that we really worked hard at is to make sure that essential goods and essential workers could continue to move across that border because, as I said, our economies and our societies are so integrated. But at the same time, we put very significant restrictions on non-essential travel. And we've been monitoring that situation very, very carefully. There's a number of data points that we track really carefully about the extent of the illness on the other side. We've also seen pretty significant progress on our side in Canada with the Public Health Agency of Canada. Our various enforcement agencies have really upped their game over the past several months. And so our tracking and tracing, our enforcement of quarantine orders, the way in which people are generally embracing the hygiene practices and social distancing practices. Most people have been very responsible about it. So we're tracking that very carefully. But at the same time, I will tell you that, in the evaluation that we do on a daily basis, the situation currently in the United States is not such that I think it's safe for us to open that border. And I think overwhelmingly Canadians feel that way. We've asked them. And we work really closely with the provinces and territories on this. And at this point in time, the provinces and territories have also been very clear that they want those restrictions to remain in place. Having said that, I also want to acknowledge that this has been hugely impactful on a lot of people. People in Canada or the United States who've got vacation properties they haven't been able to get to this summer. The tourism industry has had a major impact on this thing, and it's been impacting individuals and families. And so we've tried to the extent possible to respond in a compassionate way, but we cannot compromise the health and safety of Canadians. And we know that a border is not an absolute protection against this illness, but it slows it down. And when we saw, for example, that they had really serious problems in New York State, the movement of people from New York State into Ontario was a very, very significant concern. And so we're going to continue to monitor that carefully. The United States is still struggling with the COVID outbreak there. I think we've done some good things, but we're not going to ease our vigilance. So we're going to stay right on top of it.
So you've hit on just about every question that I have, because I know that when people hear your answer, they're going to say, what about this, what about this? So I'll work through them one by one. First of all, how do you have a sense as to how long you think the border will be closed for? Like, are we looking for one more month? Are we looking to January, February? A lot of people anecdotally give their suggestions, but, do you have a sense as to that? Or are you genuinely evaluating this month by month?
Well, it is done month by month, but I think in fairness to Canadians, you've got to give them some idea of what the future holds. And I will tell you that in my personal opinion, that the situation currently in the United States and in Canada and our ability to contain this illness, I don't see a strong likelihood of easing those border restrictions before the end of the year. I think beyond that, I'd be a little bit cautious about commenting on it. We're particularly interested as well when the kids go back to school. When the kids go back to school, people will go back to work. And we're seeing that as the provinces move through various phases of reopening of their economy and reopening of society, we're tracking really careful to see how that impact is impacting the level of the illness and the risk that it puts to Canadians. And so I think we're going to have to watch and see what happens through the month of September and October as Canadian society sort of reopens and restarts and the kids go back to school, and we're going to watch very carefully what happens in the United States. But I think, you know, the level of caution and care that we've put into this, I would just advise Canadians, unless there's a substantial change in the level of the illness in the United States or our ability to respond to it in Canada, unless that significantly changes, I would anticipate that these restrictions will remain in place through the end of the year. Also pretty mindful, Mark, the snowbirds are going to start calling me pretty soon to say, can we go to our condo in Florida? Naturally, they're going to ask. Yeah. And my only concern is that can be done safely. And when they return to Canada, Canadians can be safe as a result.
Absolutely. So, okay. So now you touched on something else, and that's people who, you know, essential travel and people who are allowed to travel. For starters, can you clarify, because this comes up a lot, the fact that, you know, I have, you know, I'll get Facebook comments from people saying, well, you know, my buddy who lives next door, I happen to know that he just went to Boston 2 weeks ago and then he just came back. We don't really, as in the Canadian side of things, we don't enforce keeping people in the country, right? Like if somebody wants to leave, it's up to the Americans, if they're going to the States, to say, hey, no, we don't want you to come in. And then, of course, if somebody wants to come back into Canada, we're not going to prevent somebody from coming home. I mean, we're not going to do that. So can you clarify a little bit about that? Because I think there are a lot of people out there that think that the border restrictions mean that Canadian officials are going to prevent people from trying to leave.
Yeah, the border restrictions we put in place with the United States are reciprocal, but at the same time, they're not symmetrical. And sorry for the big words. I apologize for that. But basically, it means we both put restrictions in place, but they're not exactly this. They're not applied exactly the same. The Americans are a sovereign country. They do it their way. We do it our way. And so, yes, if a Canadian can convince the U.S. border officers that he has a good reason to go into the United States and they allow it, then every Canadian, it's under the charter. Every Canadian has a right of return. And it's a protected right of return. So where they come from, if a Canadian shows up at our border, they're coming in. But they're going to have to submit to a 14-day period of quarantine. And what will happen there is when that Canadian who's gone down to Boston, for example, perhaps for work or for some other purpose, but has gone to Boston, when they come back to Canada, they will be ordered. It's an order from Public Health Agency of Canada, but it's administered by the Border Service officers. They're ordered into quarantine. We'll collect information. We'll make sure that they've got a plan for where they're going to stay. They can't go visit their friends. They can't go into town and go shopping. They're supposed to go home and go into isolation for 14 days. And we have really started to increase our capacity to enforce those quarantine orders, following up with those individuals to make sure that they're obeying the rules and not putting other Canadians at risk. And there are consequences if people break those rules. And frankly, enforcement, compliance is our aim, not enforcement. But for some people just don't obey the rules. And then there are consequences for that. But overwhelmingly, I will tell you in our experience, the vast majority of Canadians have been really responsible about this and we're grateful. Because that involves some sacrifice. But people are doing the right thing almost all the time. And on those occasions when they don't do the right thing, we deal with that too.
And I agree totally. And it's unfortunate that, you know, the one person that chooses not to do it is the one that ends up, you know, being, the center of attention and gets all the limelight for not doing what they should have done. But the vast majority of Canadians are doing it properly and are following the rules. And that was something else that a lot of people asked about. Well, what about enforcement? What about making sure that, you know, people, what are the fines or penalties associated if somebody doesn't do that? Do they exist or do they not exist right now? What's the situation?
There's two sets because there's both provincial quarantine and federal quarantine orders. The fines initially are in several hundreds of dollars. They can go up into several thousands of dollars. We've even had one case where one fellow, he was an American, came in and was part of what we were calling the Alaskan loophole, where people could transit through Canada on the way to Alaska up the Alaska Highway. But this guy just wasn't following the rules. He went wandering off. He was going to various tourist things. He got caught. He got fined. The next day he did it again. He got arrested and ended up being charged and brought before the courts. And so there can be very significant consequences. The vast majority of people, you know, they receive a warning, they go into compliance and we just get on with life. But for those who don't, and there have been already, you know, dozens and dozens of incidents where people have been fined very significantly for not following the rules. Relevant to Kingston, we had not so much in Kingston waters, but in a couple of our international waters, particularly on the West Coast, we had a lot of boaters, for example, mm-hmm. who were just disregarding the rules And so there has been some enforcement there as well.
Well, and that, you know, for my community in particular, this came up quite a bit. I will say it was talked about a lot more at the beginning of the summer when that boating season was kicking back into gear. A lot of people were commenting, well, I run a store in downtown Kingston, and I just had people that came in and said they had just got off a boat and they came over from the U.S. What do you recommend to people that become aware of this? I know there's the Border Watch line, you know, that people can call into. But is there also some cautionary parts there? Because, you know, to the same point, you know, people will say, well, I saw U.S. license plates. That doesn't necessarily mean that that they're not here and they shouldn't be.
We really look clear. We don't want anybody engaging in like vigilante activity here, or confronting these individuals, because there are lots of circumstances. And for example, there could be somebody living on the U.S. side. You know, every day, just as an example, down in the Windsor-Detroit corridor, about 3,000 healthcare workers who live in Windsor cross the border into Detroit every day to work.
Right.
And similarly, about 1,000 people in Detroit cross over into Canada to work. And so we've got American plates coming over. And if someone sees that plate and thinks that this person may be non-essentially in the country and starts, like, we've seen them scratch the cars and things like that, that's completely unacceptable. And so you have to understand there may be legitimate reasons why somebody's in. And for people who are not in legitimately, then certainly, like, let the local authorities know. And so appropriate action can be taken. The tools are there to deal with that. Just I would urge Canadians, understand that there are some circumstances where, you know, people are coming into the country for essential purposes. They may be coming for work. You know, you've got a large military base in your area. There are people that work over on the Fort Drum side, and there's people moving back and forth for essential work. You know, we've produced a really exhaustive list of what is essential. It really is quite extraordinary. When we look at critical infrastructure in this country, how many workers are engaged in essential work that they just, notwithstanding the problems and the challenges of the pandemic, they've had to keep on doing their work. And some of them have had to come back and forth across the border. And God bless them for doing it, because we need that work to be done. And so I wouldn't want to see a situation where one of those people was either hurt or disadvantaged or harmed in any way, because they're doing the job we need them to do.
We can't shut the border down completely. And, you know, our economy with the U.S. is so intertwined. You know, a great example that relates right back to my riding is Novelis, which is an aluminum production company. You know, the raw materials are found in Quebec, brought over for the cold press in the U.S., and then brought back over to Kingston for the hot press, or vice versa. Somebody who works there might correct me on that. But the point is that, you know, just to create a raw material into a rolled form before you even start using it in vehicles or any of the other things, there's already border crossing back and forth. And we rely on truckers and people to move back and forth on a daily basis to keep our economy working. Otherwise, I mean, if we were to literally just shut that down, as you would know better than anybody else, it would be detrimental to our economies, our way of life, our society.
You know, closing the borders to non-essential travel was a very easy part of this. Keeping it open to essential movement of trade and goods and people for essential workers was the hard work.
Right.
And making sure, like, it's something as fundamental as food on the grocery store shelves.
Yeah.
Or drugs on in the drugstore. Like, those things move back and forth across the border. For something like the auto industry that's so important to the province of Ontario, the average vehicle that's being constructed in either the Northern United States or in Canada moves back and forth across that border 8 times before it's completed.
Wow.
And so the movement of trade and goods is absolutely essential to our economy and to our society. When I mentioned the healthcare workers in some of our border communities, the work that they're doing is so important. Like, we're very grateful and fortunate to have them. We're trying to do everything we can to support them. And by the way, we've put a lot of measures in place to make sure that they can, if those who have to move back and forth across that border, could do it safely.
Right. And I mean,
because Canadians want to know, like, are we, the truck driver, God bless him for coming in, but is he a risk to us?
Right.
And so we're working really hard to manage that risk to make sure that Canadians are not put at risk.
One of the other things, and you touched on this earlier, that people ask a lot about is the definition of essential travel. You know, when a family member is, what if it's an independent child who's 19 years old, not a dependent child? What if it's a, you know, some people, two people who've been in a relationship for 20 years, but are not actually legally married. You know, some of this I realize is more perhaps on the immigration side and not within your department specifically. But can you comment on that? Are those definitions changing? Are they evolving to respond to the changes that are out there in terms of the concerns that are being brought forward?
Yeah, I am directly involved in this. Myself and Minister Minicino and I, we discuss this every single day because it was never our intention to disadvantage or hurt families. We understand the importance of people being together and supporting each other and those relationships. And so when we first put in the first order in council, which is closed the border to non-essential travel, and that when we said non-essential, it was basically for essential work, and there was some very limited exemptions that we provided. We recognized that was having the effect of separating families. And so we put a different order in council, and that evolved. And so we included people who were, you know, non-citizen spouses, people living in common law relationships. We put a number of, and for dependent children. But we're also recognizing, because I hear from people too, Mark, where people say, but we're not living together, we're not married, but we're in a very, you know, committed relationship. The challenge we face in that is how do we define that? Because on the one hand, I think all Canadians agree that we want to be supportive of those people and compassionate, and we're not trying to keep them apart. But on the other hand, how do we define that so that the Border Service officer can make an appropriate determination on whether or not their entry into Canada is essential or meets the exemptions? And so we're trying to work through it. It has evolved over time, but the principle that I sort of can't compromise is the health and safety of Canadians. And so we will always do what is necessary to ensure Canadians are safe. And at the same time, we're trying to, on a case-by-case basis, be fair and compassionate and keep families together. But, you know, the challenge for a non-dependent child, we've said if a Canadian a parent and their non-Canadian spouse is coming in and they have two or three children that are part of their dependent family, yes, they can all come in. And they'll go into quarantine and we'll put all the measures in place. But if some individuals have adult children who are living in a different country and they miss them, well, you know, I understand that. I feel very badly that the pandemic has impacted them on this way. But until we can be certain that the movement of people back and forth across that border won't compromise the health and safety of Canadians, we're going to continue to be vigilant and continue to be careful. So we look every day at how we can accommodate and you know, provide exemptions for individuals in extraordinary circumstances. But as a general rule, we're maintaining the closure for what we call non-essential travel. That's impacted the tourism industry. And it's not just families, by the way, but, you know, people's businesses have been very, very significantly impacted, and we know it. And their general lives and the way in which we live is so integrated with the United States. The closure of that border has been really impactful. And it's why we don't do it thoughtlessly. Like and it's why every single day we think about, are the circumstances changing? Is there something that we can do to ease the impact and the burden that these closures have had on Canadians? And at the same time, we hear very clearly from Canadians, they want that border to remain secure from the illness. And so we'll do what's necessary to keep Canadians safe.
My last question, Bill, just off the top of your head, do you have any quick stats as to you know, what the reduction in closing the borders has meant to actual movement? Has it reduced by 99%, 98%? Do you have an idea of how many people were crossing the border, you know, in thousands in January versus now? Just so people understand the magnitude of what this has done from a numbers perspective.
Yeah, it is very, very significant. And I do have precise numbers, like right down to we count everybody that comes into the country.
Right.
And the mode of travel. And we've got we've seen some extraordinary reductions. Almost a 99% reduction in what we call non-essential travel across the border. The numbers that are coming across, there's been a reduction of about 86% of total movement of people across our land borders. But the vast majority of that 14% that remains is truck traffic.
Right.
It's people bringing goods and services back and forth across that border. But for the non-essential numbers, we've seen a nearly 99% reduction in that. On air mode, when we initially put the restrictions in the early March, on international travel, we saw a huge reduction. The numbers plummeted. We're starting to see some uptick again there, but still we're looking at 93% reduction.
So I got to ask you this then, because you mentioned air travel. There are people that say, well, we closed our land border, but we didn't close the borders. You can still fly in and out of the States. I think that this goes back to the first question I asked you, which was, about, we're not going to stop people from getting on a plane and leaving because, you know, it's up to the country that they're going to make that decision about whether or not they want to accept them. But is there truth to this comment that we've closed our land borders, but we haven't closed other ways of crossing the border, like by air?
No, the criteria apply both at land and at air. It has to be essential. It has to be deemed essential. Canadians can always return. So if a Canadian is in Europe, for example, or in Asia, and chooses to fly home to Canada, they have a right of return under the Constitution. But for that individual, we steer them directly into a 14-day period of quarantine. And there are very clear guidelines on what that person must do to re-enter into the country. And so we can't keep Canadians out who fly in, and nor should we. They have a right of return. But for a non-Canadian coming, the only way they're allowed into the country is if it's deemed essential. And what we've tried to do is push the border out a little bit so we stop them from even getting on the plane.
Well, I was going to ask that. So does that happen? I mean, in most cases, our border agents are in Canada. If they arrive here, are we actually turning people around and sending them back?
Yeah, we actually try to deal with the air mode is really an interesting one. And by the way, this has been enormously impactful on the air industry.
Yeah,
I've had conversations with our major airlines, national airlines, and they've been absolutely economically devastated by the restrictions that have been put in place in Canada and around the world. But what we do is we push out the border and we work with the airlines. For example, even if a Canadian wants to board to return to Canada, if they're symptomatic and they're ill, they're not allowed to get on the plane because they would infect everyone else on the plane. So if that's known, that individual is steered right towards, we provide consular services and help them get access to medical treatment wherever they are in the world.
But just for the record, that's not because we're refusing to let them in. That's because the airline can't put them on the plane.
That's exactly right. Under the Aeronautics Act, they have a duty of care for all of their passengers not to expose them to that illness.
Yeah.
But for every Canadian who's not ill can come back. And then so we'll take all the precautionary measures to make sure that they go straight into quarantine and they don't expose others to any risk until we know after a 14-day period that they're disease-free. And so that's how we manage Canadians coming back. But we've also tried to work with the airlines so that if someone is boarding, and we try to make a determination working with the airlines, and we have border agents and work collaboratively with others around the world as well, so that if someone is applying to come to Canada and they don't meet the exemptions that have been put in place, then we would prefer not to board them. And we've had a number of instances where people have flown here, they don't meet the eligibility criteria, and they're put back on a plane and sent on their way. Mm-hmm. And I know that's impactful, and it's been difficult for some people. But the bottom line is, we're gonna enforce our rules. There's not much point in having rules if you don't uphold them. And so we do that. And it's not without its challenges. I'll be quite honest with all of your listeners and with you. We've got to remain vigilant, and sometimes I get lots of people saying, well, but this isn't fair, and this has been difficult, and when I miss my friend or my family member. But we really have to maintain a pretty careful track on everybody that's coming into this country. Notwithstanding all of that hard work, we're still seeing some instances where Canadians returning from overseas are infected with the illness, and that can contribute to community transmissions once they get back home. And so we're going to continue to be really careful. But I also want to provide some reassurance, Mark. We've really improved our capacity to deal with these individuals more effectively. We're now taking very comprehensive information for everybody that's coming back so that we can do the tracking and tracing. If it turns out they're ill, we can go back and see who they might have been exposed to. Our public health agencies, regional and national, have done some really good work in suppressing this illness. So when we get an outbreak, they jump on it pretty quickly. We didn't have that capacity back in March, but we've got it now. It's been built over time. Our data collection is improving. I'll take the opportunity. We have a COVID tracing app that's available. It's free. Load it up on your phone. And the more people that are actually using that, the more effective it's going to be. And its sole purpose is to protect Canadians. None of your personal information is in any way put at risk. But if you happen to become exposed to someone who subsequently turns out to have the illness, you'll be notified, and then you can take whatever steps are necessary to protect yourself and to protect your family. And that's a really good thing.
And I downloaded the app, and it's very, I mean, I think that there's a lot of concern out there that this is going to be very, infringing on people's privacy. It's going to go after information. The government's going to collect all your data, you know, all this stuff that's out there. But the truth is that it doesn't even ask you a ton of information. It asks you to record your symptoms just so that it can kind of, develop these areas of concern, and then it sends reminders and updates every once in a while. This kind of tool, I think, is what only works if enough people buy into it, right? So
it was designed to protect people's privacy, and because we understand Canadians are very concerned about their privacy rights, and we respect that very much. But it also provides some really useful information, and you're absolutely right. The more people use it, the more effective it will be. And what we're insisting on, for those who are coming into the country, that data is being collected. The most efficient way is to collect it on the app. But if they don't use the app, we collect it manually and collect that data, because we need to make sure that people who are coming into Canada, either returning Canadians or people who meet the exemptions for essential travel, people coming into Canada are going to be able to do so safely and to protect the rest of Canadians from them. I think Canadians expect vigilance from us. You know, they expect us to be fair. They expect us to be compassionate. But they want to make sure that we stay on the ball and stay on watch. And we are. We're doing everything possible to make sure that we contain this illness. As we restart our economy, as we look at finding safe ways for our kids to go back to school and people to go back to work, all of those things are critically important. And we're working really hard, sometimes just behind the scenes and sometimes kind of obviously, to make sure that this illness does not spread across our society. Because if we have another serious outbreak, we know that can impact people's ability to go to work or send their kids to school. Yeah. So we're going to stay on top of it.
Exactly. Bill, listen, you gave me more time than I asked for. I really appreciate you taking the time this morning. You have a very busy job. I bet you didn't imagine it would be this busy when you signed on for it a little less than a year ago, but you're doing a great job.
It's almost as busy as my last job.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks a lot, Bill. Really appreciate the time, man.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care.